Thank you. So the title of our talk is Towards Designing Usable Languages. Again, my name is Matt.
I'm Christian.
And really, we're very,
very
excited to be here today. So we've done our best to try and provide a high-level overview of roughly 2 times 5 years' worth of work and where we see ourselves going in the next 10. So if that's not too much for an hour, I don't know what is. And we're going to talk about 3 topics. We're going to talk first about beginning programmers and how they deal with the kinds of errors that they encounter when they're learning to program. We're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about concurrency and robotics, and then how these things come together as we look forward and ask ourselves, what does it mean to design a usable language that is fit for user and task? And so I'm going to begin by talking about beginning programmers, and then Christian will pick up the ball, and we'll have a bit of weaving in and out. Along with this, I want to stress, it won't be explicit throughout the talk, but I think that it's important to say, is that there's really two red threads to what all of the work you're going to see presented. One of those red threads is the red thread of collaboration, and I know we're all aware of open source, but I'm talking about collaboration on the level of sharing data, sharing research, as well as code and ideas. And all of the people who are involved in these projects are very passionate about the work that they do and share passions that help make exciting things happen. And so a lot of the work that we're presenting was built by trampling a lot of other people along the way. So I'm going to start by talking about exploring novice programming behavior. Right? When you talk about a beginner programmer, they sit down. We give them some tools, we give them a compiler, we give them a language. They hack. The compiler says something, and invariably it says something along the lines of, no. Do some more hacking. Okay, okay, no. And so it's this cycle that I want to talk about, but unfortunately I think we might almost want to think about the students versus the compiler, and the project I'm going to be talking to you about might be considered round one. So here we are. Edit on the keyboard, compile, and we go right back where we were. A lot of students spend a lot of time in this space. Yes, I know Eclipse has continuous recompilation, but Eclipse has a lot of buttons, and I don't know if I want to give that to every student who walks in my room on the first day. So at some point in the past, I started asking, what is it that they're doing when they're engaged in this battle with the compiler? Now, it's a story that actually goes a reasonable way back. It starts at Indiana University, where I did my master's work, took my quals. It then moves to the University of Kent in Canterbury, England, where I joined the Computer Science Education Research Group, and we continued investigating this kind of question. Now, it makes a complete jump over to the Ateneo de Manila in the Philippines, when a colleague there asked, could we continue doing work in this space, and would you be willing to give us all of your tools and methods so that we might extend it? Now, a number of things were going on in my life at that time, and in particular, starting as a member of the faculty, I spent a year visiting at Olin College. It's a new school of engineering in the Boston area, where I got to work with an excellent student in his second year, and I'm now at Allegheny College in Western Pennsylvania. And so there's this thread of collaboration that takes us a long way around. But if we go back to when I was a student in Indiana, it was interesting. The university pulled out from under our feet the way that we managed files for a course of 1,000 students per semester. And the person who ran that course said, well, we're going to have to use floppies. Right, this was before people handed out 2 gigabyte USB sticks with conference proceedings on them, okay? You know, and it's like, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to deal with all of the disk failures that 100 students per semester are going to cause me as a TA. So I foolishly wrote a hand-in system. It was called Vincent, and it allowed students to select an assignment for the course they wanted to submit, and then as a TA, you could come in and you could download the files. And, you know, so it's a course hand-in system. But here's the neat thing was you could plug in little modules to analyze files as they came in. The professors and the TAs wanted this so they could set up some automatic grading and marking type things. Again, Nothing about Vincent is particularly remarkable except for the fact that they're still using it. That, I guess it works, right? I call this grain of salt data. I call it grain of salt data because it was verbally reported to me by faculty. And they were talking about students in our first course at Indiana where they were using Scheme at the time. And they said, well, when students hand in their assignments, typically they'll turn it in 3 or 4 times. Some students, though, will turn it in 20 times. But here's the crazy thing. There's a couple of them, and they've turned in their assignment over 100 times. And I wrote this software, and I tell you, there's like 12 steps to submit an assignment, and it's really poor. It must have taken them longer to turn it in that long than to work on the homework. That tells me something very strange, and it said, well, why would students use a web-based system to turn in their work so many times? Well, sometimes, in particular, there's one homework where Scheme code is written in its own abstract syntax, right? So it's really easy to pull it apart and analyze it. And they would often say things, well, problem 17 was supposed to use a cond statement, but you used a nested if. Perhaps you should go back and try that problem again using cond. Now, if you think about this from the perspective of a compiler, that's a very high-level semantic compiler. That tells the student something far more useful than error end of file, because some parentheses were missing. And so I think the students in this category were students who decided the feedback from Vincent was at some level better than the feedback that they got from the tools that they had on their desktop. And so it takes us back to this picture that even though we like to say things like syntax doesn't matter, it's not interesting. The really interesting thing as students are learning computing and programming is the semantics and the problem solving. And I'm not going to take that away from you. But I am going to insist that for somebody who comes in who thinks computing is cool, and they sit down and we give them the Java C compiler or GNU CC, and I look out at this room and I know all of you know the kinds of errors this compiler spits out, and I know all of you know what those errors actually mean. But I don't think my students do in week 2. So, looking at novice programmers at the University of Kent, the University of Kent is gloriously situated on top of a hill looking down into the city of Canterbury, overlooking the cathedral. Note, it's not raining that day. And at the University of Kent, they develop BlueJ, which is a pedagogic environment for introducing students to object-oriented programming in Java. And we also use it there at the University of Kent for introducing students to programming in Java. How many of you are familiar with BlueJ? Okay. This is what the environment looks like. You can create a new class. And then you get a UML-like diagram. You can double-click one of the little UML boxes. And then you get a text editor that doesn't have any particularly special features. And here I'm adding a field to a Java class. I'm going to initialize it in the constructor. I think I then add a constructor here in case I want a constructor that takes 2 arguments. This.x equals x. This.y equals y. Definitely some of the most advanced code you've seen presented here today. I can get rid of a method. I should note that BlueJ, as a matter of pedagogic principle, never presents students with a blank page. The authors of BlueJ feel that you should always provide students with some kind of skeleton or template so that they begin by editing code and reading code, not by writing from nothing. And here I've just added some kind of mutation method that will update the field x. When I get a syntax error, BlueJ, again, as a matter of principle, only reports the first error. In this case, I forgot to specify that this is a method that returns void. Once it compiles successfully, I can then come in and I can say I'd like a new point object. Here I'll use the constructor that takes no arguments. I then get an object. Objects are red rectangles. Please remember that in your own programming. Objects are red rectangles. I can now come in here and I can inspect the state of the object. It'll show me all of the fields that are part of that object. Here I can inspect the one I constructed with arguments 3 and 5. I can also then invoke methods on my objects interactively And here I'm going to set the value of x to 42, the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And I can come back in and inspect the object and see, yes, I have affected a state change on that object. So that's BlueJ in a nutshell. That's the majority of the environment. It also has some features for unit testing and whatnot. But that covers enough of what you might need to know about it for today's talk. My research pretty much looked at this button, the compile button. Right? Invokes the Java compiler, spits back an error. Over the course of 2 years, we looked at 120 students, 2,000 separate programming sessions, roughly 42,000 program snapshots. Every time a student pressed compile, we got a complete copy of their code, IP address, time of day on client and server, all kinds of various bits of metadata, including things that would let us know who did it, so we could go back and correlate this with information like their course mark. And this study has now been replicated and extended at the Ateneo de Manila University in the Philippines, as well as an independent replication recently reported in SIGSE 2009. So the numbers I'm going to present to you are from the initial study at Kent, but they have been upheld, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you the error bars between the studies today, but they've generally been upheld and are consistent. First of all, more often than not, students encounter a syntax error when they compile their program. That might not be surprising to you at all, but that means, you know, whenever they push the button, it's probably going to be wrong. And the distribution of errors is kind of interesting. The missing semicolon is not the most common error the students encounter. It's unknown symbol variable, probably because they made a typo in the name of a variable. They forgot to declare it, something like that. They always forget semicolons. They make various kind of bracketing errors, various mistakes in spelling of methods. But these last two, roughly 5% of all errors are either application errors or they are illegal start of expression. The illegal start of expression error is the most likely to be repeated the longest. Because, of course, it really doesn't tell the novice a lot unless they happen to really understand BNF and the grammar of the language in week two. The top five classes of error students encounter in Java when they're dealing with Java C in some kind of direct mode are caused by the five most common error types. Did I say that correctly? Well, I'll move on. I don't know if I just said something that was completely nonsensical there. The top five error classes represent more than half of all errors students encounter when they're beginning to program. That might have made sense. Let me give you a sense for what this looks like, though. Right. Edit compile. This is a reconstruction. I pulled this from real data, but it was not that I was recording the student doing it. And I assure you, no undergraduates were harmed in the making of this video. So we start. I have a class, I have a field, and I have a constructor. What could be simpler than adding one more field to this class and initializing it? So they add another variable, and they initialize it to zero because it's what we tell them to do. They know they're supposed to initialize it. Would any of you like to tell me what syntax error is generated at this point? A bracketing error? Would anybody else like to take a stab in the dark? Private int y? Semicolon. All right, we have three. The compiler says semicolon expected. Now, if you are a student learning to program and the compiler says there's a semicolon expected, what are you going to do? Yeah, you got that right. You're going to put a semicolon there and hit compile again. And actually, the majority of all compilation events take place in less than 30 seconds, and a surprising amount less than 10 seconds. Oh, I talked through the good bit. I'm sorry, it said semicolon expected again, and they put another semicolon. For good reason, the compiler said so. All right, so now, I'm all kinds of ahead of myself. Yes, here the compiler says, yes, you need another semicolon. Now, they've already got two. So this is another strategy students commonly employ when they encounter this, which is if you've got a line of code that's recalcitrant, you just need to get rid of it. So you recompile your code, And when you do that, it says, cannot find symbol variable y. Why? Because you have to declare the variable before you use it. They've seen this error before, too. So what are you going to do? Would anybody like to take a guess? Get rid of the comment. Obviously, you needed to declare y. So they come back and they uncomment that line of code and recompile. Which point it says semicolon expected. Now at this point, remember, this is all I have. So if you are trying to project an emotional state onto the student, I can't capture that. So the student does the natural thing and says, you know what, that might not be where the semicolon goes. I'm going to put one on the line before. And here's the money. Who would like to tell me what error this produces? Not a bracketing error. It's number 25 in this study. It's in the long tail of less than 0.5% of all errors. Missing method body or declare abstract. Week 2 of learning to program. Would you care to explain that to a novice programmer? Because I wouldn't. Now, it's all caused by the fact that they had one blank line in their code. So yesterday, we saw the programming environment. I don't know, I'm way ahead of myself. That's in the last part of the talk. And so I have a student. As an instructor, I can look at them, but what I cannot see is what is up here. They might be thinking about going to the pub later with their friends. They might be thinking about having lunch because class is at 11 o'clock. And so what I can look at, though, is I can look at how they interact with the compiler. And that's a powerful lens. So what does the data look like? Well, I can visualize it this way if I want. And I can say the student spent a few minutes hacking their code, and then they hit compile, and they got an illegal start of expression error. On the x-axis are minutes. On the y-axis are categories of syntax error. So after they compile, they get an identifier expected. They take a few minutes. They recompile. They get semicolon expected, and they get that one really quickly. But it might be that they're still in the same part of the code, and they get an illegal start of expression error again multiple times, regardless of what they've edited. All right. This session that I pulled this from actually lasted for 45 minutes, during which the time the student never saw their code compile. Now we can contrast that with a student who had an easier time, but we can see immediately this class at the bottom, which is no syntax error. This student spent a substantial amount of time working on code that was correct. This is novel, isn't it? This is the first time in my talk I've mentioned a student getting code correct. And so this is completely different behavior. And what we started to wonder is, what can we tell about this? And actually, using some relatively simple metrics, we can pull a lot of information out. I assure you, I spent a long time looking for very complex methods. But if you actually then dig in and you do some qualitative work and document analysis and dig through thousands upon thousands of incorrect programs, you can say that, well, if I take pairs of events, and then much like Spam Assassin, I assign penalties to certain things, like were they both a syntax error and were they the same, I can actually develop a measure that we're calling the error quotient for a given session. And what we've demonstrated currently is that it does correlate. Not causal. We have some correlation with how we then traditionally evaluate students in terms of homeworks and final exam mark. But I still have this problem that my students are editing and compiling. They're not running their programs. And I'm going to posit they're certainly not learning about encapsulation or inheritance if they're spending all of their time chasing syntax errors. So can we use this instead of the summative evaluation that we are so fond of, right? 4 weeks in, I give you a test, you get a C minus. I say, well, it's still within the add drop period. Maybe you shouldn't be in my class. Well, that's a really great way to not increase enrollment. Maybe I'd really like it if when students start to have frustrating experiences during the semester, that I have tools that let me do formative evaluation. Tools that allow me in an ongoing basis to be aware of how my students are doing in, say, the task of learning to program. So it might be one direction we want to go is towards developing some tools that allow me, in potentially in real time, to say, here I have a room full of people surfing the web, I'd like to know if they're correctly typing URLs. And I could see all of you and say, oh, some of you, you can't spell Google. Right? But I could very quickly say, wow, I better go help Tom, because Tom is having a hard time right now. Or I could even walk into the lab looking at the student's progress from the previous 3 days and know who I want to focus on during that session. Or send them an email and say, why don't you come into my office? So in terms of collaboration, the reason I'm able to present the results that I'm about to share is because when I finished my PhD, Didith and her students picked up the ball and did some really marvelous work. And that was really scary for me because I hadn't even had a chance to publish articles based on my dissertation as I handed off all the tools to continue to the research. But as a side effect of that sharing, we now have a really exciting collaboration and are working together to continue this kind of research. I naturally went on to do a postdoc in wireless sensor networks because that's what you do after you study novice programmers. I spent a year as a visitor at Franklin W. Olin College and worked with Michael Hughes, an excellent student. And Didith then was a Fulbright scholar at Carnegie Mellon this last year, and so I got to meet some colleagues there. And that was really handy because Allegheny College is only an hour and a half north of CMU. So we were able to do some really nice things and continue communicating and collaborating this last year. So the results, Emily did the work on correlating with traditional performance metrics, correlation with frustration. Ryan Baker does work on gaming systems. And so he and Didith actually then expanded this work and did some observational studies in the classroom and were able to begin correlating affect with automatically detectable states. The problem is it takes about 5 weeks to build a correlation with frustration. So we need, but we can. In other words, when you're sitting there going, that kid must be really frustrated, well, it turns out they are. post-compilation behavior, Mike looked at what happens when the code compiles, and it turns out when you give scanf and printf assignments that involve format strings, we looked at one group of 160 students or so, and 100% of their runtime errors came from format string errors. 100% of the runtime exceptions were from format strings. Why? Because it's a language that the compiler doesn't check, buried in another language. And so we'll actually, that'll be a little bit of a theme for the next part of this talk, and it's spawned some new questions and collaborations. And ultimately, what we're going to be doing is weaving in this notion of studying people using languages as an interface, as an ends to a mean. Wait. As a means to an end. As a means to an end, to talk about how we think about designing programming languages. Now, at this point, I'm going to pause for questions, because we sort of go off in a different direction, and we've accounted for time in this way. You're welcome to ask questions later about this part of the talk, but if you had any questions about this work on novice programmers first, I wanted to take a moment, let you stretch, you just had some to eat, maybe go for a jog around the room, and see if you had any questions about this work. But you don't have to ask questions.
I'm going to ask a question.
Yes, sir.
So I wasn't quite clear. Have you actually implemented the real-time observation? Because it seems to me that if I knew I was being watched, right now I'd start working smarter. But as a first, two-week student, I don't know if that'd cause me to compilation 8 times so you'd come over and help me, or if I'd get really frustrated and like run away so you couldn't know it was me.
You're exactly right. I actually had a colleague at Kent who wanted a red light above their monitor and a siren. That remains future possible work, but and the real-time live might not be of value because of the question you raised, right? However, certainly saying, wow, I know I'm able to, you can do homework over the course of the week, and when I come into lab, I can actually help you with something that you were struggling with. I think that's probably less scary. But you're right, there's a lot of human effects because this is work that crosses between languages and people. So you're absolutely correct. Yes, sir.
So even if you don't monitor the students in real time and they, you just get the information offline, do you think that it still affects their behavior in terms of compiling more or less?
All of this work is done with human ethics approval, right? And the students in my studies opted in. We used opt-out protocols at the Ateneo, but it's invisible. And I don't think the students even, I think it's a complex question. Will it affect their behavior? If the effect was that it made them think more, then that's an interesting result. that by knowing that somebody is watching it with the aim of helping, that they actually concentrated more. And keep in mind, none of this is done, for example, with pair programming. I have no idea what it looks like to observe pairs. I have no idea what it looks like to observe Python programmers. So I can't make, from my data, I can make no statement as to the effects that you're asking questions about.
Thanks.
I'm curious if you have any data on the trending behavior over the course of the quarter, whether there was an uptick or a downtick, or whether you saw any particular hurdles that people were having trouble getting over. I know the folks at Cambridge did some interesting studies on the particular hurdles that beginning programmers face and where they run into the most trouble.
What's that? Yes, I might know the work that you're talking about. I have it in my notebooks, and it never actually made it to the dissertation or even a paper yet. But actually, these error rates, of course, vary. And a lot of things do vary because, of course, you're going chapter to chapter, concept to concept, and new syntaxes and part of the language are coming into play. And so over time, you see shifts in terms of the kinds of errors that the students are seeing. But no, I haven't had a chance to dig into that deeply. Good question. We have time, I think, for one more question at this stage, and then we will move on. Please.
Have you considered, I'm from New Mexico, and you may or may not know that the Wind Talkers of World War II were Navajo natives who not only spoke in probably one of the world's most complex languages, but in code on top of that. Have you looked at cultural, geographical, ethnic, blah, 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 all the implications of that on what you're doing?
It's a very good question. I think it would be a challenging question to pull apart. I can't speak to it from my data. What I can say is that between the data that I collected regarding undergraduates studying at the University of Kent, who are a very diverse group but largely English, we had substantial populations from a wide variety of places. And at the Ateneo, large populations of all Philippine students from the Philippines. And the most recent replication work was done here in the States, and we haven't yet seen any large discrepancies on the large-scale data. But I do believe that there are certainly going to be cultural differences in terms of how students approach faculty for help and what they feel comfortable doing. So I think there's a lot of cultural things that will get that are obscured perhaps by the larger N aspects of the data that I showed you. Is that a fair enough response? Let's say I believe that there certainly are effects, but I don't have any data that would show it. All right. And you're welcome to ask more questions about that as we go. I'm going to hand off to Christian, who will take over the next part of the talk.
So we'll switch gears a little bit, perhaps, and now talk about concurrency and little robots. And what we're interested in is to teach parallelism. We'd like to actually get concurrency and parallelism in early when we teach students, because those are very important concepts, not just because these days you can't buy a computer, a laptop, you know, without multiple cores, but also because it can be important for other reasons, such as we can structure our programs differently, and given the right tools, this can be very powerful for students. But what we don't want is we don't want to take an existing sequential language like C or Java and you know, slap some kind of library on top of it, because the compiler doesn't know how to help the student at this point. It's very easy to introduce a number of errors that the tools just can't see. So what we want is we want to use a language which gives the student more support in writing correct programs. And we've chosen to use a language called Arkham, which has been used a lot at the University of Kent throughout the years. We also, when we teach in general, but also concurrent languages, we'd like it to be fun. But also we'd like it to be authentic. We don't want to say, well, you know, let's sort of list the names in parallel, because that's not necessarily very meaningful for the student. We want there to actually be a good reason for us to introduce concurrency. And this is why we come back to a shared passion, one of those red threads, and also collaboration, where Matt and I have both been very excited about the LEGO Mindstorms. And we've used this the LEGO Mindstorms and other devices as an authentic motivator. And what we have here is one of the early LEGO bits that we built. As you can see, we're not very good at building LEGO robots. But this is a simple line follower with two sensors. And it's running a parallel program on the LEGO Mindstorms with about 10 processes running in parallel. And it does reasonably well following the line. And how is this authentic? Well, what a robot generally does is it needs to sense its environment, needs to think about what that input means, and then it needs to act. It needs to do something. Now, you might see this as a sequence of steps that you do, but this is not how we generally tend to look at it. The sequentiality is implied probably by the way that you've been brought up in programming, and we really see this rather as an opportunity to say, well, actually, we can sense, and we can think, and we can act all at the same time. If you have the right tools, that's not a hard thing to do. And this is the kind of picture that we like to draw, where we have multiple inputs, multiple outputs, and we can split up our internal logic and compose individual, smaller, more self-contained bits of the control logic together into a parallel program that eventually does the right thing. Also, we want this to be fun, and certainly the robot here seems to be enjoying itself. And also, we've been part of the first LEGO League at the University of Kent, and this is a picture from one of the years that's run at the University of Kent. And that's middle school students who come together in order to solve a problem that's been set by the committee. And it's usually they try to root it in real-world problems, and they have to do this with LEGO robots. And they get to build their platforms and solve these problems in a competitive manner. And this is a big worldwide event. And the students think this is fun, but it's also it gives them an authentic set of things to do where they actually they are motivated by the fact that they're doing something that's real. Now, why do we choose Occam for this? Now, unfortunately, we haven't quite got to introducing Occam into the first LEGO League, but we might get there. Why do we choose Occam for this? Well, Occam is a parallel programming language. It has concurrency at its core. The syntax and semantics allows you to express concurrency. But also, it does a lot to help you not make a range of common mistakes, which, if you're just let loose to your own devices, are actually quite easy to make. In Occam, we cannot introduce race hazards. We can't have a global writable state. There's no pointers. We cannot introduce aliasing. And the compiler does parallel usage checking for us. So if we try to do something that we shouldn't be doing, like writing to the same variable in parallel, the compiler comes back and says, no, I'm sorry. This is not allowed. And so that helps us to avoid the kind of things that really actually are quite easy to just, even if you're a professional programmer, to deduce by mistake. And certainly this is a bonus for more novice programmers who are less likely to think about these kind of things. Also, in Occam, we have to explicitly introduce non-determinism. Unless we use explicit syntax that actually allows us to do that, there won't be any non-determinism in our program. And what I'll do now is I'll just hand over to Matt for an example.
And so in handling non-determinism, it's really kind of fun that we can write a parallel program that is completely deterministic. And sometimes I don't know. This is just wild conjecture. But when we talk about parallelism, I think it's too easy to think that that somehow means randomness. Right? It doesn't always. And so this example is couched on the Surveyor SRV1. This is a commercial off-the-shelf robotics platform that you can buy for about $400. It's powered by the Analog Devices Blackfin processor running at 500 megahertz. There's 32 megs of RAM, 802.11g radio, other critical bits. A webcam running at a ridiculously high resolution. And you see up front the two little gold disks. Those would be death ray lasers. So those are a good bit, really. And this the example is a robot that marvels at the color purple. It's a robot with impeccable taste. And what it does is it's going to get an image. It's going to have a process that then splits that data into two parallel streams. This is a data flow language. And so concurrently, we're going to be evaluating the luminosity in the image frame and generating something that we pass on, which we then say, ooh, well, that's really bright. I'm going to go forward fast. And so a command is then sent on to the motors. Or we might see something that's purple. And if that's the case, it's time to stop. Because purple's really good. So the important thing is that there's this continuous stream of data along the top, and we have effectively random events that come from this process running concurrently called likes purple. And back there, we call that a delta, anything that splits one stream into two. So on the upper left, you see what my MacBook Amateur is capable of seeing. It's recording a live stream. In the upper right, we see what the robot is seeing. That's delayed just a little bit. And in the lower right, the robot is telling us things. So here I start things up, the robot starts rolling forward, and then I hold out this purple book. And it says, woot, purple, or purple woot, and it stops. I take away the purple, it keeps going, and I stick it back out and say, no, look, purple, stop. Right? I can take the purple away. And so what we're doing is we're seeing a random event that's being integrated into a control system in a controlled way. This video was actually taken in Boston, and I'd like to point out again, it's a sunny day in Boston. It's really hard to take these videos on sunny days, given where they're taken. So all of the magic that allows us to control the non-determinism happens in that one block labeled alt. Depends on if you call numbers letters and letters numbers, you might call circles blocks. So that circle labeled alt is where I actually say, one of these two streams of data is going to be ready at some point. When it's ready, process it and do something. And so I've constrained all of my non-determinism in this code into one space. So kind of nice from a pedagogic point in that we're able to actually make that a teachable moment and constrain the teachable moment and introduce it at some point in a controlled way as opposed to it happening all over the place at any time.
So we've been using this stuff at the University of Kent for teaching. One of the motivators for doing some of this, some of the things that we'll see is to get Occam to run everywhere. It runs on the desktop. It runs on Windows, Linux, of course, and OS X, because that's what we tend to use. On the desktop, we might run programs such as this one. This is a game made by Adam Sampson at the University of Kent, where you get to shoot parrots out of the sky. Very exciting. But the point here is that actually everything you see on the screen and a lot of things that are not on the screen are processes. So when you shoot one of the parrots out, you generate explosions and feathers fall off. And those are all individual processes. And as you might see up there in the corner, there's a process counter so you can see how many processes are running at any given time. So as you can see, with Occam, having a few thousand processes is, nothing we really think hard about. In fact, on desktop class machines, you know, we can reasonably trivially deal with millions of processes. To move on to another example, which is a Boyd's example, also by Adam Sampson. Here again, each individual Boyd that's flying around on the screen is an individual process. And the point here is that we can now, you know, run our program on a multicore machine, and the processes just get scheduled around to run on the multicore machine. It's not something we have to do anything extra to deal with. This might not be that clear, but this is Adam Sampson, who then got to take his Boyd simulation to the northernmost university in the world, University of Tromsø in Norway. And they have a large display wall with about 7x4 back-projected screens, where they ran, again, the Boyd simulation distributed. So this is a rather large screen. Again, we're talking about small changes to actually get this stuff to work. We also have been doing some work with various students where we've been running Occam on the Pioneer robot, which is that thing you see running around there, trying not to bump into too many things. We've also been working on the little robots that you've already seen, the Surveyor SOV1 and the Lego RCX. Some of that work comes back to one of these red threads, which is collaboration, which is the transterpreter that Matt and I have been working on now for a rather large amount of time, since 2004, I think. That is, we needed to be able to run Occam on these small robots like the Lego Mindstorms and anywhere else we felt we wanted, really. So we sat down and wrote a virtual machine to allow us to port to anything that anybody liked to throw at us. The general porting time is somewhere around, for an initial port, is somewhere around one medium length conference talk. That's where we did most of our porting. Where are we going with all this? Currently we're working on another little robotics platform, which is the Institute for Personal Robotics Scribbler Fluke combination. But what we want really here is affordable toys. It might be nice to kit out a classroom or the like with a bunch of RCXs or some surveyors, but they are reasonably expensive, so we might worry about them breaking, and we certainly don't want to, you know, give our students these to take home when the course is finished, because it's not something that you probably casually replace. It's quite a lot of money we're talking about. Certainly the Pioneer is in the range that you don't buy a whole classroom full of these unless you're a very good institution. What we want is, you know, something in the order of tens of dollars. For that, we're going to be looking this summer at working on the Arduino. The Arduino is a open source, open hardware platform with a range of small processors you can plug in. And they're modular as well. So they have this concept of a shield that you can fit on top of this thing, which has all the sensory equipment or whatever else you'd like to plug in. And so you can either build your own, make some circuit board, or you can download and etch your own stuff or buy it pre-made. But there's a large community around the Arduino, which we'd like to tap into. There's a bunch of different targets we might want to look at. The Arduino, which cost about $20, 32K of RAM, 32K of flash and 2K of RAM. The Sanguino, which is the device that gets used on the RipRap 3D printer, a bit more expensive, bit more power. And then there's the Arduino Mega, which is just huge, really. The possibilities with 8K of RAM are really endless. But our goal is to get something that we can, you know, give to the students. They can do stuff with it in class. They also have something that's authentic for doing concurrency. We can give them multiple inputs. They can have to deal with sensory data coming in from multiple sensors. We can motivate the concurrency. We can hopefully make it fun, and we can give them this thing to take home, or they can buy it themselves because it's not that expensive. They can also take it back to their parents and say, "Wow, I have this little thing. It's crawling around on the floor and doing whatever," which gives us hopefully also, you know, a bit of a wow factor that you don't get with sorting a list. We want them to be able to take this home and show their parents what they're doing. But we also want to reach out to the existing community around the Arduino and hopefully give them some fun new toys and tools that they can play with on these things. And what we're really looking for here is a project stepping stone. We're looking to cap off the work that we've currently been doing in order to be able to step up to our next goal, which is what Matt will be talking about now.
It's very polite. I will do my best not to rant. We've just given you an overview of roughly 2 times 5 years worth of work. And so now what we're going to do is, you know, we're going to try and tie these topics together, where we're headed over the next couple of years. Beginning programmers, concurrency in little platforms, and really the goal is providing an authentic context for introducing concurrency and parallelism. And the umbrella that we're going to put this under is the notion of designing usable languages for this task. And as I was saying to a colleague last night, anytime somebody talks about developing another programming language, you really should shoot them down. I don't mean that you should get up and ask a polite question that hamstrings me and makes me look like a fool. I mean you should shoot me down. Because at some level, we don't need another language. So with that said and acknowledged, if you will allow me to continue. Right? Design is hard. I hope that in this community we acknowledge that. I don't know what you think. Maybe some of you think that in terms of whatever it is, complex middleware systems, compilers, embedded systems design, I'm going to postulate that design is hard. It's hard to do well. It's hard to get right. And actually, traditionally, it goes poorly. And this might be where things like the agile process comes from, and some people think agile is no good, and some people think it's great. And it doesn't really matter, because what we're all debating is around this point that getting design right is a challenge. I'm not going to propose a solution to that, per se. I will have a little fun at design's expense, however. You may have seen this gag before. It's a series of images. The customer tells you exactly what they want. They're really quite clear, and you walk away quite clear. The project leader says, "Team, I know what we need to build. The customer has described it to me." Well, that's okay, so the analyst goes off and does a bit of design work, because they were in constant communication via phone, via Skype, email, IRC, Twitter, and any other collaborative tool you choose. So the analyst design comes back, the programmer goes to town, probably a team of programmers, very well managed, lots of unit testing, right? Lots, you know, rational rows, pick your tools, it goes well, it's tested, goes through BuildBot, awesome. The documentation, well, we had to let them go, the economy is rough, we just couldn't keep hiring these literature majors from small liberal arts colleges to write our documentation. So we're sorry about that, and actually, for what it's worth, the support staff kind of had to go too, but Joe the engineer, when he's not hacking code, just gave up sleep, and he'll return your call during the hours of 7 to 9 p.m. Hawaii Standard Time. And this is all they really ever needed. Right? I'm afraid I can't even give you an attribution for these images. Go look for... I'd have to look up the Google search, something like design failure, tire swing, or something like that. whether or not there's a grain of truth in this humor. There's a grain of truth in it, and at the same time, you know, I'm being unfair. But what I want to do here is put this in the light of how we looked at the kind of data that I've seen novice programmers wrestling with Java. And I believe, maybe someone here will correct me, I believe Java was developed by a Skunkworks team for set-top cable boxes. And then it was unleashed on us as the write-once-run-anywhere solution for the internet. And Java now runs everywhere. And I'm not saying that's bad, but I am saying that Java was never designed for my novice programmers. I'm glad we use it. I'm glad some people use it successfully. But I think that it's not a tool that was designed for them. A slide that I didn't have a chance to slip in was a recap of the language Scratch, designed at the MIT Media Labs, where we have a long tradition of focusing on novices and programming. Seymour Papert, who in the 60s was developing Logo and the Logo Turtle. Right? The Lego Mindstorms is the great grand robot. Grand it. We don't really have the gender neutral, right? It is a direct design successor, and Logo Blocks, which is what Scratch is built on, comes out of that same tradition. So these are tools that were designed for novices. No, you wouldn't go and write your industrial control system in them, but they are great if you want to introduce an 8-year-old to programming. I'm perhaps beating a dead horse, or a live horse, or I'm beating something. The iPod Shuffle, I thought, was really a marvelous piece of design. Right, the iPod came out, and people, oh, yeah, the iPod. And so, but they would want to go jogging or biking or something with their iPod, and it cost a lot. And the iPod Shuffle was this low-cost solution. It had one button on it, and it let you play your music, and really, you just wanted to hear it. And then you saw all these weblog posts like, my iPod can read my mind. It comes up with just the right tune as I'm trying to be Lance Armstrong going up the hill. It's like, well, okay, cool. But there was an entire market created because you couldn't attach this thing to your body. It had a lanyard. And really, you don't want to go jogging and have this thing bouncing on your chest. It doesn't work. So this was the design response with the Shuffle 2. They turned it into a clothes peg, right? It has a clip. You can attach it to your shirt. You can attach it to your hat. You can wind the headphone cable around and drop it into your ears. It was designed so that you could attach it to yourself and you didn't need anything else. And I'm just going to claim that at some level, this is excellence in user-centered design. There's a few of you who are clearly Apple fanboys and girls in the audience, and some of you who have ThinkPads running Linux. I support that wholeheartedly. And regardless of how you feel about Apple, like, there's some really good design that's going on, and it's really focused on what people want to do with these products. So, looking forward, I'm weaving arms. Do you see the waving arms, right? But I don't think it's unreasonable that we know that students go through a complex process, and maybe I don't even want that process. Eclipse has already taken the process away for me, right? But they're clearly editing and dealing with errors. I'd like to, in terms of concurrent, I'm sorry. It's obviously we. Really be nice if we could get rid of this cycle in terms of teaching students about designing concurrent and parallel systems. Locks and semaphores are how you implement concurrency and parallelism. They are not patterns for parallel design. And I'd really like it if they can see those patterns and express them more directly in a way that is appropriate for the beginner. I'd like to have an authentic context. See, I switched right back to I, but it's what I want. I'd like to then see them using it, and I'd like to study them using it in a variety of ways, and I'd like to feed that back into the language design process. I'm on video. I'm going to say it anyway. Programming languages isn't all type theory. It's not all... Wow, that's pretty good. Right, that matters, and it's not that I'm ignorant of it. Yes, there's a BNF. Yes, we have to program to the underlying machine, but that shouldn't drive the language design process in all cases. So there's a complex loop here. I'm sure we'll have it done by next Thursday. Because you might be sitting here saying, Matt, I don't even know how you're going to tackle that one. And I believe, and I myself can't tell you fully how I'm going to tackle this one. I know I've developed tools that allow me to look at novice programmers. I know that we have, you know, a rich history in our group of working with parallel languages, and we chose Occam because it has a 20-year history. Occam is not brand new. The transputer was designed in 81, and it's based on Hoare's CSP, which he developed in the 70s. It's probably, I think, the first process calculus. Is that true? Don't know. But it is certainly an early process calculus. And so this, the tools surrounding Occam, there are books, there are resources. So we picked starting points that we think are rational, and we've chosen an impossible task to motivate the next few years of our work. But I do have a real motivation. Right? There's another Dr. Jaded. She got her PhD from the University of Wales in literature. She's not writing any documentation for anyone, as evidenced by earlier slides. But we did start another project, which provides a different kind of motivation. And so over the next 10 years, I have some motivation. When my son sits down to program these kind of cool embedded systems and make robots run around, I really don't want him to be learning to program embedded systems in C. I want him to learn that second, because we're probably still going to be programming embedded systems in C. Or maybe Java, or maybe Ruby on Rails, or I really don't know and I don't really care. But I do know that when it comes time for me to introduce him to the cool world of embedded systems and robots, that I want tools that were designed for him. I think I'm paying a big personal price by being here during his 13th week of life. This is also my way of acknowledging the fact that my wife is at home with Matthew, but he has been sleeping through the night during the last week and a half, so I think she's getting full nights of sleep at the moment. But I'm sure her days were harder than mine while I've been at Usenix. So we'd like to acknowledge a number of people. In talking about novice programmers, we've completely left out, and I meant to add before the talk, everyone at the University of Kent. My supervisor, Sally Fincher, the Blue Jay team, Michael Kerling, Ian Udding, Paul Henriksen, colleagues of ours at Monash, where Blue Jay work also takes place. And in terms of the research that I presented here, Dith Rodrigo at the Ateneo de Manila and her students, Bea, Emily, Jessica, and current students who are doing additional new interesting work, Mike Hughes at Olin College, and Ryan Baker, formerly at Carnegie Mellon, now starting as faculty at Worcester Polytechnic. In terms of the parallel programming, and we also forgot to add, Fred, Damien, Carl, Adam, John, Peter, and David Wood have all been incredibly supportive and did much, you know, have built a foundation upon which we were able to stand and trample. And a lot of the work on the surveyor was then run live in class with in a Taurus course co-taught with Dave Barrett, and the students there at Olin College were really great and just beat on our system. And we are happy that our tools held up, and they gave us lots of great ideas for where we might go in the future. So those are the people. Those are just some of the people we can think to acknowledge in the kind of work that we presented. If you are interested at all in engaging with us, we don't have any hashtags that you can use on Twitter. You know, I don't know if we have these videos on YouTube. Perhaps we will certainly be providing the talk, and we'll be putting it online ourselves. If you're interested in us coming and talking, if you'd like to come and give a talk about work that you think is of interest and related, we'd love to have you. If you're interested in any kind of collaboration, if you say, well, we've got this funny little device, and Matt, why don't you guys see if maybe you can, what can you do that's cool with this? But really, I'd like to say that if you have any kind of interest in collaborating on student projects, maybe you have students that you'd like them to tackle something during the summer or during a semester, or if you have any internship opportunities for students who are excited about these ideas, I'd love to hear from you. And so two URLs, baseplate.org is where currently we've got some projects going with undergraduates at Allegheny, and transterpreter.org is where you can find some of our software. We're refreshing a lot of things, and we're excited to have a lot of the team together here in the U.S. for the next 3 weeks. So this is going to be a dynamic space, and we're just really excited about having a chance to share some of that work with you and the kind of things that are going to come next. So thank you very much. You get to say thank you if you want.
Thank you.
And we didn't rehearse this bit. And And so if you have any questions, that's it for our presentation today. How do we do? Look at that. We're pretty close to done. Yes, sir, please.
You missed your question, I guess. Again, thank you both for this great talk. In my opinion, the slide with your son should have been the very first, and here's why, and I'm going to ask you, and not joking, have you consulted with or will you any Piaget experts to help you with your process and your research and understanding? And I think you know who Piaget is.
Yes. I also know who Vygotsky is. That would be wonderful. I certainly am going to, as we move forward, it's always bad to talk about future work in some ways, but I know at Allegheny we have some very good people in the psychology department. Absolutely. I'm always happy to talk with people who know more than me about things. I believe I'm reasonably well-read in this space, but it doesn't make me an expert. It does not make me somebody who explicitly deals, say, with child development and, you know, the learning of various kinds of problem-solving skills at the ages 8 to 12. That is not my specialty. So, certainly.
Charles Perkins, Mimetic Technologies. What motivated you to choose Occam specifically?
I can go. So Occam has a long British tradition. The transputer was developed, I believe, at the University of Bristol around 80, 81. Sir Professor Tony Hoare, Order of the OBE and recipient of a great many awards, including the Turing Award and the Kyoto Prize. I was also one of Her Majesty's subjects. And at the University of Kent, there's been a long tradition of research in this space. So Occam was being taught on the desktop. And it was not clear from students writing ASCII animations that it was necessarily a parallel problem that they were solving. So part of the motivation was simply to say, you know, we can take Occam and put it on these small devices, but we really didn't realize that porting to a black box system where your debugging link is an IR link, you have minimal documentation except for what the community provided as in terms of reverse engineering, only 32K, and it's a different Endian system than what you're developing on the desktop. That was the Lego RCX. So that may have been one of our big mistakes, but it made us consider a lot of hard problems up front. But that was, the motivation was local. It was and not only that, though, if you look at other parallel languages like Erlang, Erlang requires a fairly large resident, if you're familiar with Erlang, developed by Ericsson for telephone switches, a few years back it handled some obscene percentage, like 60% of all Japanese cell phone traffic. It's used heavily in telecommunications routers. It needs a resident image or on the order of megabytes, whereas our virtual machine sits in under 12 to 14K of flash, and the surveyor operating system requires 300 words of RAM. So we're actually able to take an Occam program and run it in these tiny spaces, and most of our exploration as we've moved out from the Lego is because we realized, wow, I can write PAR, have 10 things in parallel, and then run it on an embedded processor. And the runtime handles the scheduling really nicely for me. So a lot of what came after was opportunity. But we're solving a very concrete problem initially, which was, can we give our students at Kent the opportunity to program something really fun? Thank you.